Beta would take the kids to McDonald's. He's not going to have some lecture about like, oh, that's not healthy.
What does that even mean?
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and the Democratic primary field just got one Texas-sized addition to it. So let's get that music rolling. And former congressman from El Paso, and I guess you could call him the runner-up in the Texas Senate race, Beto O'Rourke announced that he is running for president, or at least that's what happened if everything is going according to plan. For the sake of transparency, I'll let listeners know that we are indeed recording this on Wednesday, March 13th, because we have a hunch that Beto might be announcing on Thursday. So if you're wondering how we got this podcast up so quickly, it's not magic. We just
Does
had
that
a
involve
hunch.
Reporting? I thought we were data-driven. We weren't allowed to do reporting, Galen.
I don't know. It might.
You're not allowed to both use numbers and report. That's the rules.
Okay. Well, sorry, I guess we're going to cancel this podcast then. You guys, we'll see you back here tomorrow when Beto does it. No, I'm just kidding. All right. Here with me to talk about how Beto could either win or lose the Democratic primary are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate. How's it going?
Hey, Galen. It's going well.
Awesome.
I'm
happy.
Having a Red Bull, which actually don't have nearly as often as you would think. But today, this Beto cast got unexpectedly added to my calendar. So I have to gain energy here.
I'm all for it. And also with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire, how's it going?
It's going well, Galen.
Awesome. And as you'll hear, Claire is joining us remotely because, of course, this is something of an emergency event that we have going on here. But anyway, let's dive right into it. Claire, you wrote the theory of the case for how Beto could become the nominee, which is up on our website right now, again, if everything is going according to plan. So let's begin with you, Claire. What is Beto's ideological or policy background, and where does he fit in generally within the party?
Well, I think if we are going by our colleague Perry Bacon Jr.'s taxonomy of the left, he's kind of like a new guard progressive. So he's certainly left-leaning. He wrote a book about the politics of the border vis-a-vis the drug war. So he's certainly been, you know, very early was sort of a legalization advocate for marijuana, decriminalization advocate. In some ways, he is a bit of a blank slate. Now, this is a bit unfair because he is a three-term congressman, but he hasn't taken a lot of big litmus test stances that a lot of the, say, senators who are running for president have had to take. In the Texas Senate campaign, which is basically how he got nationally famous, he largely got a lot of attention for his comments about what the reasoning or validity behind NFL players kneeling during the national anthem was. So he's kind of gotten this virality over almost like social issues and this kind of positive, happy warrior vibe. So, you know, no shade to his three terms in Congress, but he doesn't have a whole lot of the kind of national litmus test stuff that we've been used to with a lot of these senators running for president.
Would it be fair to call Beto a moderate?
I mean, I think he is a rhetorical moderate in some ways, which is to say that he is, as I said before, a happy warrior. He's not going to be your, when they go low, we go lower. In the infamous words of Eric Holder. He's not going to be that kind of guy who's super angry at Trump. His whole vibe is very earnest. I would also say that the fact that he is a white man running with a progressive platform does give him some sort of moderate patina, because there have been a lot of discussions within the Democratic Party about this primary season being a little bit of a, I would call it sort of a false choice, but there is some choice to it of, do we appeal to white voters who left the party, or do we really try to gin up the support of faithful constituencies of women and minorities? And Beto, I would call a stylistic moderate, because he has done a lot of the sort of, listen, we should listen to everyone. We should try to kind of build a happier politics. And so I think you would call him a moderate on that front. But I think in the 2019 Democratic Party, he's decently progressive.
Nate, where do you come down on this?
I'm on the Beto as a moderate side of the ledger. And I'll tell you why, because I'm using data.
Okay, go for it. Give it to us. I don't know. Is that shade? I'm not really sure.
I've just been talking out of my ass for the past 10 minutes, I guess.
I think there's also to be, is it Beto or Beto or something.
I think it's just Robert Francis, actually.
Robert has voted with Trump 30% of the time so far, which is one of the higher ones among the potential and actual candidates so far. Also, he's one of the only candidates, along with Tulsi Gabbard, who has voted with Trump more often than you would expect for a member of Congress from his district. Because it's a very blue district, you'd expect it to elect a Democrat, in fact, a liberal Democrat, who would vote with Trump 19% of the time. He's voted with Trump 30% of the time instead. So he actually has a positive Trump plus minus score, which means more voting with Trump than you would expect.
And do we have a sense of what kind of issues he's voting with Trump on versus where he's breaking with Trump? Are they substantial issues that matter to Democrats in terms of how they see a moderate versus a progressive?
I don't have that data in front of me. I mean, I think sometimes these candidates will vote with Trump less often on the higher profile issues where they think their vote is going to be scrutinized the most. But the point is, this is not someone who comes from a deeply ideological place. You know, he got lumped in. All these kind of New York Times people were like, oh, you know, profiles were like, oh, you know, new progressive candidates such as Beto O'Rourke and Stacey Abrams, blah, 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 blah. Those are all really different, you know, to lump him together in with candidates who are definitely running to the left. You see, oh, you know, Elizabeth Warren and progressive challengers like Elizabeth Warren and Beto O'Rourke are challengers to Bernie. Granted, it's all like a lot mushier than people like us want to admit. It's not like it's all on some Cartesian plane where you're coordinating five dimensions on the issues, whatever else. But again, based on the voting record, he is someone who I think he would say he's trying to serve all the people of El Paso and not just be a partisan. Of course, he'll become more liberal and left, you would think. Well, actually, I don't know that, right? I mean, the most prominent kind of policy stance he has taken so far was saying, you know, I actually think even in El Paso, I would take down the existing wall, which is on the issue of immigration, pretty far to the left. More so, I think we have not heard a lot of other Democrats say tear down existing walls, and so they say don't build new ones. So it could wind up being that he winds up owning the border slash immigration issue and being more kind of flagrantly on the left on that, and then some of the other stuff being more toward the center. I mean, I don't know, right? He has the advantage of having had a lot of other people declare first, and so he can try to figure out how to position himself relative to that field.
And I'll just say, he was asked whether or not he considers himself a progressive, and he said that he doesn't like labels. So take that for whatever you will. So let's get to, I guess, the important part. Claire, what is the theory of the case for how Beto could win the Democratic primary?
Well, if you look back at his 2018 Senate race, which you undoubtedly heard a lot about because you're listening to this podcast, O'Rourke did really well in turning out and getting up support in urban and suburban areas in Texas. And I think that that tells us something about the sort of voter who he might excite nationally. I think, Nate, what did you call them in your five corners? Like the millennials
and friends.
Yes. So I think O'Rourke is certainly a candidate of millennials and friends. He is also potentially, in his potential coalition, he could be a person who might endear himself to Latino voters. He is not Latino, but obviously the district that he represented on the border is pretty Latino. He has famously or infamously taken on a childhood nickname that is Spanish. Beto is, you know, a diminutive for Robert. So he certainly has experience appealing to that demographic and also might want to count on that support. I think, though, that his kind of strongest subgroup is almost like, it's almost similar to what I would have designated like the Hillary Clinton supporter during the last primary season. These kind of yuppies, like young suburban urban yuppies.
Yeah, upwardly mobile, craft beer drinking.
Oh my God, you're going to bring the beer into
brunch
it.
Brunch eating, I don't know.
He also, I should say, is, maybe it'll be spoken, perhaps unspoken, is he is a white man. And I think that there are a lot of people strategically within the Democratic Party who say like, well, maybe we should get a white man to appeal to all the white men we lost in 2016. And O'Rourke might do that just by his very person, while also perhaps pleasing the more, I don't know, again, woke yuppie crowd.
Yeah, no, I mean, and look, these are relatively fine distinctions, right? Like, I didn't maybe mean to imply that they're all like hipsters or something. In fact, I think kind of one of the things about O'Rourke is that he's kind of this upper middle brow candidate. You know, if you really, really pay a ton, you have to bleep that, I guess, of attention to politics, then maybe you want someone who's a little bit wonkier, like an Elizabeth Warren or whatnot. You know, I think a lot of the appeal with Beto is like, hey, look, he has kind of vaguely liberal positions. He's not too extreme, but he's also not out of touch like an older, you know, Biden might be. I think he can beat Trump. He can raise a lot of money. It's kind of fun to go to his rallies. You know, there was some meme someone tweeted at me where they have how they would classify the different Democrats based on if they were driving the car and the kids in the car wanted to go to McDonald's, right?
Mm-hmm.
Beto would take the kids to McDonald's. He's not going to have some lecture about like, oh, that's not healthy.
What does that even mean?
I saw this meme. The triangle included when the kids in the car scream, McDonald's, McDonald's. Does the adult say, yeah, McDonald's, let's go to McDonald's?
Whereas Joe Biden's say, like, oh, we have food at home.
Yeah,
right?
And the one of the options was, oh, we have food at home. And then the third option was they pull up to the drive-thru at McDonald's with kids cheering to go to McDonald's, order a single black coffee, and drive off.
First of all, that's pulled from a John Mulaney comedy stand-up thing. And also, kids, not everything you read on the internet is a good analogy for politics.
Okay, that is 100% fair. But I think a little bit what you're getting at is force of personality, which is why, in addition to maybe millennials and friends or maybe Latino voters, people have talked about whether he'll appeal to Obama world, and I guess that means the establishment. But do you think that is a fair analysis of Beto, that his force of personality is somewhat similar to Obama's and can appeal to the people who got on his train?
I think Beto O'Rourke is a candidate that is in some ways a good match for Trump as a person who has had a outsized impact on American popular culture in the past 6 months. And you could call, you know, he's sort of got the, like, you know, the basic Beto appeal, right? Like, people who don't pay attention to politics know who Beto O'Rourke is. And that is powerful in 2019, when politics is pop culture, when you need someone who's maybe a little bit defined outside the realm of Trump. I mean, if you could make a critique of someone like Elizabeth Warren, it's that she's been kind of in a slugfest with Trump for a couple of years, and maybe voters get tired of that stuff. So I think perhaps the, like, number one selling point of O'Rourke is his skyrocketing fame. And that's why a lot of these people from Obama world, staffers and everything, have behind the scenes or in public been very supportive of him, have compared O'Rourke's, the feeling of O'Rourke's campaign to early Obama campaigns. I mean, this is a very explicit thing that is happening with some of these Obama people. Like, they want to tie, you know, the misty magic of the Obama years to O'Rourke and put him out there as the great white hope, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, and you do hear from Obama people that, like, hey, you know, he is very magical in a room. And you go there and you're cynical and, like, he really knows how to, like, work a room. Whether that's true or not, a lot of the hope for him is that he would be a good retail campaigner and that would help in Iowa and perhaps New Hampshire as well. There are a lack of candidates from the middle of the country. I am using that phrase a bit ambiguously because, kind of, you know, El Paso is sort of the middle of the country. It's also not the Midwest. But I think, you know, I think he would lean heavily on a strategy where Iowa figures prominently. Also, where there's, like, some ambiguity about kind of what he really thinks. And, I do think the discussion around, like, race and gender is relevant. You know, I do wonder if deep down Democrats think, well, you know, the easiest way to beat Trump is with the white guy. Although, again, there are good reasons why people would say O'Rourke is electable. By our metrics, he performed strongly relative to the partisan baseline in that Texas Senate race.
And he lost by 2.5
points. Lost by 2.5 to 0.6.
Well, because, in part because he has, Nate, I think you dinged me at the top of this for saying that you had the data and I was sort of describing this.
I was being very snarky.
No, I know. But I do think it's this real thing with O'Rourke where the face that he puts out to the world, the vibe he's sending out to the world is, like, super progressive. But if you are, like, an Iowa activist who's really getting down nitty gritty with him in the details, and you are maybe, let's say, like, a middle-aged white man who's on the fence about some of the more progressive left policies of the Democratic Party, and you are doing the, like, up close and personal talk to the candidate, you might, like, look at his record and say, like, oh, he's actually not that liberal, so I'll vote for him. So it's almost like O'Rourke is a little bit having it both ways, and that's electorally advantageous for him.
Yeah, I'll actually give you an example of this. I was down in Houston for a while during the midterms covering the election in Texas's 7th congressional district. It was a district that ended up flipping to Democrats. And I was block walking with activists and talking about the Democrat who was trying to flip the district there. And there were a lot of complaints that she was too moderate, that she was maybe a little too like Hillary Clinton, a little too stuffy establishment. And then they were talking about Beto O'Rourke, and like the activists' eyes would like light up and they were all enthusiastic about this guy Beto, who, you know, if you looked at the issues, didn't have a substantively different policy platform compared to Lizzie Fletcher, the person that they were saying might be too moderate or too establishment. So yeah, I mean, that definitely, I saw that on the ground in Texas during 2018. But before we move on to why or how Beto could lose, let's dig a little bit deeper into the data. So it's early days, and we maybe shouldn't put too much stock in this. At the point of his announcement, so we can maybe compare later on down the road, how is Beto doing in Iowa and in polls nationally, and maybe even in prediction markets?
So in polls, he's generally around 5 or 6%, which is actually down. I mean, he had a phase in like December before other people started declaring where he was often getting 9, 10, 12, 13% in polls. Under the surface, his favorability ratings have not changed that much. They worsened a little bit, but they're still pretty good. But he clearly is not, has not been top of mind for voters. And so this momentum that he seemed to have right after his loss, actually in Texas, November, December, a lot of anticipation of, oh, he's actually probably going to run, I think wore off through this kind of process where he was being kind of weird.
Maybe, and by that you mean writing blog posts about traveling the country?
Running blog posts, Instagramming a lot of things he was doing in his life as part of a project to document how people in El Paso felt about the border. Yeah, I think the Jack Kerouac-esque road trip where he's traveling Route 66 or whatever, I mean, I think that was felt like a little weird.
But you always say you want a Gen X candidate for president.
Maybe that's the appeal, that Gen X has been skipped. You know, as a 41-year-old, as a Gen Xer, tail end of Gen X, you know, I want to like weigh in heavily for Gen. But there's a Gen X sensibility.
Oh, yeah.
And Gen Xers are not that liberal necessarily. Gen Xers are kind of more conservative in certain ways.
On that note, I would just recommend that everyone follow a Twitter handle called Beto's Fake Blog. It is excellent.
Again, with prediction markets, I mean, Andrew Yang is currently the fifth most likely Democrat on prediction markets, to provide some context, although we are now treating Yang as a major candidate. It's another discussion.
That's another discussion.
That might, though, lead you to wonder, are the types of people who are betting on prediction markets, it's often kind of younger white guys, and Beto is a candidate that probably appeals to younger white men, as actually Bernie does, and as Yang does. But he does do relatively well on prediction markets. He's at about 15%, which is third, or fourth rather, after what I think are the three obvious front runners, meaning Biden, Sanders, and Harris. And so people are saying that, hey, actually, he stands out from the Warrens and the Bookers and the Klobuchars and the Gillibrands, despite having less experience politically, or at least a lower office than they do.
He's maybe more in a class with Andrew Yang then.
Well, Andrew, that's okay.
I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Don't test me, Galen.
I will also say that he's definitely slipped in the polls, but I think that he has been maybe overcovered by the media in some ways. And so I can definitely see his just media presence shooting up. And by media, I mean not just journalistic outlets, but like his appearances on, like, say, Colbert, or, you know, Late Night with Seth Meyers, or The Ellen Show. Like, I can see that stuff ramping up pretty quickly. And this is kind of like a teaser, but we are, I think, going to have something coming up about just sort of media analysis of O'Rourke's kind of
meteoric.
Thank you. His meteoric rise. So I think that's a big factor in that I would watch for, to see if it helps his poll numbers kind of creep up.
Yeah, definitely what his rollout looks like. Let's get a little bit into why he might lose and also who his biggest competition is. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Trip Actions. There's a reason half of business travelers do not use their company's chosen travel management platform. Booking business travel is still ridiculously outdated, time-consuming, and costly. If you're frustrated with your company's travel management program, or lack thereof, look into Trip Actions. They take the pain out of corporate travel with a complete solution that helps businesses save and keeps employees happy. The reason TripActions works so well is that it's the first travel management platform designed from the ground up with the road warrior in mind. Companies large and small see over 90% adoption and save up to 34% on travel when they use TripActions. And so if you're somebody who's interested in changing how your company does travel, go to tripactions.com/politics, complete a 30-minute demo with a TripActions account executive, and you'll get a $100 Amazon gift card. But it's only this month. TripActions.com/politics for a free demo and a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's TripActions.com/politics. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Upstart. Applying for a loan is a lot like applying for a job that you don't get to interview for. Instead, loan companies make their decisions based off your credit score and history without getting to know the whole you. Now, thanks to Upstart.com, it never has to be that way again. Upstart is revolutionizing the way you borrow money by rewarding you for your job experience and education in the form of a smarter interest rate. The best part, once your loan is approved, the funds will be transferred to you the very next business day. Over 100,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards, student loans, fund their wedding, or make a large purchase. Free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and it won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/politics. So just as we asked how Beto could win the Democratic nomination, let's talk about how he could lose it. Claire, what's the most obvious path to him losing the Democratic primary?
I think it has to do with O'Rourke has been a congressman. So first of all, people typically do not get elected president directly from Congress. The only two people who have won the presidency from the House were Abraham Lincoln and James Garfield. So that's not recent. But what I'd say is that O'Rourke hasn't run a national campaign in the way a presidential campaign is. Now, obviously, there have been other people who have, you know, run their first big presidential campaign and won, but he's running against people who have been thinking about this for years, have been planning it out for years. I think that he did have what seemed like a real period of waffling. In fact, to quote him and his live journal thing, he said he has been, quote, in and out of a funk. So, you know, it's not necessarily an office running. It's not necessarily an office that takes to that kind of sort of existential questioning well. And then the other thing I would say is just, and it kind of is in keeping with first major national campaign, super high profile. I mean, just the spotlight on presidential candidates is really different. And we have to go to this DWI thing from 1998. Now, O'Rourke acknowledged it from the first time he ran for office, but during he got a DWI in 1998 when he was 26 years old, and in this campaign more detailed reporting came out about the incident where O'Rourke had tried perhaps to leave the scene of the crash, which he maintains he never tried to do. But my whole point in saying this is it is possible, see Ralph Northam's blackface incident that was never caught during the entire, you know, vetting process or Oppo research. It is possible that maybe there's something out there about O'Rourke that you missed. So, like, to me, I see the potential for O'Rourke to falter as almost being like the new kid, perhaps inexperienced route. Does that make sense? Like, it's the kind of X factors that we don't know about yet.
Like, he hasn't had multiple statewide campaigns during which for people to mine his history.
Yes, or even to go back to the first part, which I think is important too, that he doesn't have the same kind of I've been laying the ground for this campaign for years sort of thing going on, which again, maybe his media superstardom will kind of make that not matter, right? But that's something to consider.
I'm not sure that I buy the vetting issues relative to other candidates. He did run a very, very high profile race. It was probably the highest profile Senate race of last year, to the point where
certainly the most expensive.
And Ted Cruz unearthed a lot of stuff, right, about how he used to be in a band and stuff like that. I'm not sure he's all that effective, really, about this DUI where he was alleged to have left the scene. You know, so it's not like he's totally green. To me, it's like, I mean, first of all, most of his candidates are going to lose. If there are 20 candidates running, 19 of them are going to lose.
That can't just be your answer to why is Beto going to lose, because most people are going to lose.
So why is he going to lose? Among other reasons, because maybe people think it's too much fluff.
maybe he is kind of too stuck in the middle between different constituencies, and his constituency is not that well defined. Maybe he is relying heavily on Hispanic voters as part of his coalition. There's a whole debate about authenticity, and that means something different to Hispanic voters nationally than it does in El Paso. Maybe Julian Castro gains momentum and directly competes with him for resources. Maybe there's a little bit of the Marco Rubio syndrome, where he kind of has this label as like kind of a bright rising star, and it's actually more of a burden in the end, because it always means that like the expectations that he's always kind of on the verge of a breakout, and that helps for a certain length of time, but then that kind of fizzles. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why he wouldn't win.
I think he risks high risk, high reward, in the sense of his star could burn bright, but it could fade out just as fast. Like, he could suffer backlash of people being like, why do we want an inexperienced white guy, for instance, when we have all these well-qualified women, female candidates, you know, like, let's, and like the tide turns on him and people say, well, if we want a white guy, why don't we go with an experienced one like Biden, blah, blah, blah. Like, I see it as being kind of almost like pushback to the phenom.
Would we say that Biden is his biggest competition?
They're certainly competing for, yeah, I'd say some demographic, right? The moderate white guy demographic.
I mean, I think he's competing more with Biden than Bernie. Although, again, if you look at age, and I think it's easy to kind of forget age as an important parameter, certainly for young millennials, about half of Bernie's coalition in 2016 was people who were on the left. And about half was just kind of millennials who are like, you know what, Hillary Clinton is old news. I don't like her. Bernie's kind of cool. He's talking about free colleges and better policies toward college debt and everything else, right? He's speaking to people like me going to college campuses. You know, Beto would kind of compete with that, right? So I think you saw some tension between Bernie fans and Beto fans on Twitter and so forth back in December. And I think they're right to be like a little bit eyeballing one another, because the non-ideological young voters, right, might be good fits for candidates apart from Bernie. So that's a big vector. But yeah, I mean, he does kind of like, he is kind of in the, like I said, positioned kind of in the middle of a lot of different people, right, where he's certainly not going to, he's going to position himself probably to the left of Biden, and or maybe not to the left per se, but like, he doesn't have this whole track record he has to defend that Biden does. And so in some ways, the fact that he's a blank slate can be an advantage. I mean, this is true for all candidates to some extent, but it varies with Beto. Like, his strengths and weaknesses are kind of two sides of the same coin. The fact that, like, he's a little wishy-washy and mushy can, to some people, be an advantage, because it means that you're not overly committing yourself to certain ideas. You can have a broad-based message. You can be very articulate about delivering that message. You know, I think the comparisons to Obama are somewhat unfair to think Obama had done a lot of thinking about public policy and public life before running.
Obama was a constitutional law professor. I mean, he had a lot of training. He was in the state Senate. And O'Rourke, listen, this is no shade, but like, his background is very different. You know, he was like a tech guy before this, before he ran for Congress. So it's an extremely different pedigree.
Whether or not Beto wins, he's now running. How do we see him shaping the debate over the next year within the Democratic primary?
I think the media will feel like, we're a little bored now, and some of these new candidates have flops. We're like ready to turn the page, another chapter. So I think that like timing actually might help him a little bit. I think the media thinks that, oh, it would be boring if we just had Biden and Bernie, and so therefore we need someone new. And
the young gun who's going to storm onto the stage.
The rising star.
Yeah.
Right? So in that sense, I think weirdly like his timing is maybe kind of good. There is like a little bit of a Wizard of Oz aspect to this all. Like, what's really kind of there behind the curtain, and like, why does he want to be president, and what does he think his life experience gives him as a perspective on, you know what I mean? That seems like a vulnerability for him potentially.
Well, in terms of how that shapes the debate, are you just saying then experience becomes more of an issue? You know, if it's Sanders versus Biden, sure, Biden has more experience, but Sanders has an awful lot of experience in the Senate. Kamala Harris as well has an awful lot of experience as the Attorney General of California, as a senator from California. Does it become more of a, do you have the experience to lead if we're arguing about against Trump? Then
I'm not sure that Beto has that interesting a life story.
I don't know. He was a Manny.
Yeah. I mean, he was in a band, went to Columbia. But,
well,
like,
you know, this
but like
is
by
how...
comparison, like Obama, whatever. Obama had an interesting life story. Donald Trump had an interesting life story. Bill Clinton had an interesting life story, right?
maybe not like they're not like Mother Teresa, any of them or whatever, right? But they have different sets of experiences, right? Pete Buttigieg has an interesting life story as being kind of openly gay mayor of this modern Midwestern town. I mean, you know, I'm not sure what Beto has in that department. But again, there are a lot of people who are like, you know, maybe you don't need that. And he is just kind of a generic slash safe Democrat who happens to have considerably above average communication skills.
In some ways, he has, if we're thinking about life stories, he has the most in common with Bush 1 and Bush 2 in the sense of, like, he doesn't have any kind of traumatic, you know, bootstrapping childhood stuff like Clinton or Obama did in the sense of absent fathers or whatever, you know.
Bush 2, for sure, although Bush 2 had the story of, like, redemption from alcoholism and stuff like that, right? You know, and Bush 1 was a fight. I mean, Bush 1 had some heroic things in his background, right? That's what I'm saying is, like, I'm not sure the bio holds up that well. But he can also tell a story of finding himself, and maybe that appeals to Gen Xers and stuff like that. And there are a lot of people for whom he'll seem like a normal, regular guy who you want to have a beer with, a craft beer with.
It's maybe worth saying that the Club for Growth, a, you know, conservative political group, is already running ads against Beto on exactly this line of attack, saying that he's privileged and with a charm life like Beto's, you can never really lose. You know, they say he drips with white male privilege. I guess they're trying to appeal to Democratic primary voters in the terms that they would used to talk about somebody like Beto. I don't know if that's an indication that they're afraid of him or what, but the line of attack that you are expressing there, Club for Growth, the conservative group, has already jumped on.
Yeah, I thought they did not do a very good job of that. I thought the critique sounded like it was written by a Republican trying to mimic how Democrats talk, and that they should actually have talked to some Democrats and not have this, like, white-sounding woman talk about, like, white male privilege. It just doesn't really work. But that is a critique that you'll hear. You know, he is a candidate who generates a lot of debate and discussion, and when you have a take, you have a countertake, and when you post something about Beto, it gets lots of people reading it. And I guess, you know, that seems like kind of industry talk that wouldn't matter, but there is something to being like a focal point of discussion when there is a field of 15 or 20 candidates. If you generate discussion a la Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, and you're a distinct brand, then that kind of advances you to the semifinals. And so if you're looking at, like, okay, which one of these candidates, no one has better than 20% chance, but who has a 20 or 15% chance? You know, someone who, because he has a distinct brand, because he is telegenic, generates media attention. It is interesting, by the way, I mean, you talk about, like, gendered discussion of the candidates, right? I do wonder if Beto were a woman, if there would be more discussion about how he's kind of like a pretty face, right? Empty suit and not all that substantive.
You mean we haven't talked about Beto's boyish good looks on this podcast before? You just said he's telegenic. I was wondering if we were going to make it through this whole podcast without talking about Beto's looks. His Kennedy-esque appeal.
But if you had, like, Kirsten Sinema or someone running for president, which, who knows, could happen in 4 years or 8 years, it seems like that might be a bigger topic of conversation. I don't know.
Well, listen, guys, you don't really have to look far to find a rising Democratic star who is a woman whose looks are commented on as well as purported vapidity. So I think we have a good comparison for how people treat women who are rising media stars and telegenic in AOC, right?
That's a good point. And I think with that, we are going to wrap up the Better or Work theory of the case. Of course, we'll be talking plenty more about all of these candidates in the coming months. But for now, thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And before we go, important to remind you guys that we have a live show on March 20th in New York City.
Folks, come to the live show. We just opened up balcony seating, which means that there are more seats than we originally had available, but they're good seats. The live shows are always fun. It gets a little bit goofy sometimes. There are segments that will never make the air that you can kind of hear us. And we never say, like, different stuff, but, like, it's kind of fun to participate.
Sometimes it's a little more crude.
There's a lot more swearing.
And also, maybe we'll have a draft. We haven't had a draft in a while.
Probably do a draft.
Head over to 538.com/live. All right. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Remember to rate us or tell your friends about us. We are going to likely have another podcast about Brexit coming out tomorrow. So stay tuned for that as well. A lot happening across the pond. Until then, thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.